Well, listeners and viewers, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Working Within podcast. This week or this month, I'm extremely excited to be sharing with you Ms. Wanda James to join the podcast and season three this day, week, whenever we're viewing this. I actually had the opportunity to hear Wanda speak as part of this program that I want to promote and let you all know about too. It's called the Urban Leadership Foundation of Colorado Connect Fellowship. The Urban Leadership Foundation of Colorado is dedicated to empowering Black leaders in Denver to reinvest in their communities and reinvest in themselves. And it's been really cool, and you'll see through this interview already the types of topics and people that we get to hear from as part of the cohort in 2022 is Best Class. Yes, thank you, Wanda.
So many women.
Yes, so many Black women. Mm-hmm. So many Black women. So important. And Wanda came to speak to us, and she gave a talk called Pot, Power, and Politics. And for many reasons, I fangirled over that talk. It really resonated with me. I had a lot of epiphanies. When Wanda and I talked again, I had more epiphanies. And so I'm so grateful that she has decided and agreed to come on Working Within to share a bit more about her story. And, you know, this is a really pivotal moment for Working Within, and I promise I'm going to stop talking and let Wanda introduce herself. Working Within has typically followed a very neutral, abstract, meta type conversations. And I think today, and with the slew of guests I'm encouraged to bring on the show, we're getting a bit more pointed, and I'm getting more pointed and more focused and passionate and advocate oriented on the show, or advocacy oriented. And so this is just going to be the beginning of that. So yeah. Anyway, so thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this show. This one will not disappoint, nor will any of them. But yeah, now to Wanda. Wanda, thank you so much for coming on the show. Could you please introduce yourself to the listeners? Please feel free to include your pronouns, what you're doing now, and anything else, and your zodiac sign. Very important to the listeners.
That's so funny. I love my zodiac sign. So first off, I am a proud, proud Virgo, because Virgos are, I'll be honest. Virgos just think we're the smartest people in the zodiac. So that's our claim to fame, you know. But anyway, Wanda James, she and her. And thank you for doing this podcast. One of the things that I love most in the world is talking about what I do and talking about how I got here. And along with that being one of the most favorite things, because I believe that, and I'll get more into the introduction, but one of my favorite quotes, Nelson Mandela made it famous, but it was actually Marianne Williamson, that's called Our Greatest Fear. Our greatest fear is not our failure, our greatest fear is our light. And I feel like what I love to do is to be, because I'm unapologetic about everything that I do. And so in shining my light, it gives permission to people to shine their lights. And I think that the one thing that women, and especially Black women and Black people, or people of color, have been taught for so many generations is tone down. Don't make people feel uncomfortable. Keep your head down. Don't let them know how smart you are. Forget that noise. You know, come in hard. You know, yeah, Virgo, smarter than you. It's what I do. No.
Oh my God.
But no, it's not about that. But I mean, it really is, but shine your light, right? And so when I think about what I do, or what I've done, first person in my family to graduate from college, first commissioned officer in my family from a long line of military people going back to my great, great, great grandfather. First African-American woman, or first African-American period, legally licensed in America to own a dispensary edible company and a grow facility in the cannabis space. And I hope that there are more firsts in my lives, And so what I get from those firsts, I mean, you know, the haters are like, yeah, first. I don't say that to be braggadocious about it. I say it because it really is sad that my generation, that even coming up in the late 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, I should not have the opportunity to be first. Mm-hmm. There should have been a whole bunch of firsts before me. And it's crazy that we're still talking first. So my goal in life is to make people shine their lives, to go do what it is that they want to do, to be bigger and better and stronger, and know that you can do it. Because you know what? It really is just putting one foot in front of another. Because jokingly, like I, you know, said, being smarter or whatever else. Yes, I'm smart. I'm not the smartest. Yes, I'm driven. I'm not the most driven. Yes, I'm accomplished. I'm not the most accomplished. Because so many people are afraid to put that first foot out there, right? You know, the journey of a thousand miles begins with one step, right? Yep. Black girl, put that foot out there and step, step, step again. Step again. I didn't know when I went to college that I was going to be the first in my family to graduate. I never thought about that. That wasn't a thought. We didn't have terms like first gen back in 1981. It was just like, go to college, So this is what I do, I think, is, and that's why I wanted to back into what I do. It's not the job that I do or the CEO or running the business. I think what I do is give people permission to shine. And I want you to shine. I want everybody to find that light and to shine. And if it happens to be a Black woman that's shining, I want y'all to glow. Glow.
Yeah.
Glow. Supernova glow.
Yeah. Supernova. Oh my gosh. Oh, good.
Blind some people with that glow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, that's so. This interview is gonna be a training ground for me, so I can reel it in a little bit. But no, I'm shining. We're glowing together.
We're glowing. It's supernova up in here.
And what you mentioned about being unapologetic, there are layers to this. Okay, what I just mentioned about me learning to be more unapologetic on my own show, I like was constricting myself on my own show for a long time. Firstly. Secondly, watching you speak, seriously, it I admire so much how unapologetic you are in everything you say, because I completely resonate with that tone it down language and like propaganda that Black woman, other woman get so often. And it can be so hard to feel affirmed as a powerful woman. And not to say that you want to abuse your power, not to say that you're in it for power, but it to be a powerful woman can be so hard just because everyone's saying you shouldn't, or if they're projecting that you shouldn't have that, or you shouldn't stand in that energy that makes you glow and be the supernova. So anyway, thank you for saying that.
Well, it's kind of crazy too, because you get the, one of my favorite fun quotes is, you know, may you have all the confidence of a mediocre white man. I mean, it's amazing. And that's what I'm saying. When I started all of this, I am not remarkable in anything that I do. But what's remarkable is that I keep doing it. Right? Do you know what I mean? And have there been setbacks? Yeah, loads of them, all the time. But it's not how you get knocked down, it's how you get back up, right? And those setbacks for me aren't what I use to define me, right? You know what I mean? Because, you know, another thing I like to bring up, when a baby begins to walk or crawl, right? A baby doesn't take a step and then fall and its parents go, oh man, what's wrong with this kid? You know, he took one step and busted his head, you know, just let him stop now. But we're embarrassed that you took that one step and busted your head. We're embarrassed. Ah, you know, mm-hmm. It said no parent ever, mm-hmm. Right? That's the level of life, right? When you go to college, guess what? You're going to take one step and you're going to apply and you're not going to get into two of your top 10 colleges. But you keep trying, right? And if you really want to go to Harvard and you didn't get into Harvard that first time, fine, go to your community college, take 3 courses, and then apply to Harvard again when you know what it's all about, right? It's not how you fall down, it's how you get up, you know? And at every step of the way, if you continually to challenge yourself, you're not gonna be able to walk. When I opened a cannabis business, nobody else had ever opened a cannabis business. Guess what? I fell down, busted my head, and got back up, right? Because there was no rule book on how to run a cannabis. Here's how you open a cannabis business. That book didn't exist, right? You know, I'm running for CU Regent right now. I've never run for CU Regent. Guess what? I'm gonna fall down on that first step, and then I'm gonna get back up because I've never done it before. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we fill ourselves with this idea that everything that we do out the gate must be perfect. Mm. And that's just stupid. That makes no sense, no more sense than watching that baby take a step and falling and then criticizing it, right? So yeah, it's not how many times you fall, it's how you get back up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And as a serial entrepreneur, I think both of us resonate with that. That's a pretty integral part of taking those steps. You cannot nitpick. You can't aspire to perfection, especially when you're piloting, when you're first starting something out. And I've learned a lot about that. Okay, the podcast has come a long way. But
yeah, and when you look back on it, you're like, oh, that, like, what was I thinking about then, you know? Or even now, when I look back at the old business plans that I wrote when we wrote our very first restaurant business plan, I have it from the Jamaican Cafe in 1993. I have this business plan, and it reminds me of just how far I've come. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous business plan. I'm like, oh my God, what is this, you know? But you know what? That was my first step.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a glorious first step because that very first business plan, that very first restaurant, that itty bitty little restaurant in Santa Monica, California, is the reason that we have this dispensary right now, right? Because that restaurant was the first step.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, it's exciting to me how it all kind of plays itself out.
Of course it's exciting. You do not need to, you don't need to anyway yourself. It is exciting. And I think, you know, putting that energy out, like, to bring it, this is how I speak about it. Okay, you don't have to subscribe. But when you're putting that energy out, like, over and over again, that you're ready and you're going towards something and you feel like it's really like trusting your gut and trusting yourself to, like, just go again and again. When you do that, and when Miss Universe, she sees you doing that, she's gonna keep giving you the stuff to go because you're going. And that is awesome that you have cultivated that all the way to owning your own cannabis business, especially as a Black woman. So I wanna applaud you and celebrate you. And I hope listeners and viewers, you applaud and celebrate how tough and important that is. Okay.
But you know what? It's bigger than that, though, too, because it's not just the cannabis business, right? So the cannabis business for me is a means to an end. Mm-hmm. Because from the cannabis business and the cannabis space, the real work for us has been ending mass incarceration, ending the drug war, ending in Denver, Colorado, 97% of the arrests for simple possession happen to be Black. Mm. You're here in Denver. Outside of the ULF class that we just taught, I have never seen 97% anything in Denver, right? So, I'm sorry, we have reduced the arrest rate in Colorado now by 97% for simple possession. And all of that came out of this fight for cannabis and ending the drug war. 34% of the arrests in Denver were for simple possession happened to be Black. Which is crazy because we don't see 34% of Black folks anywhere in Denver except when we start talking about things like arrest rates and unemployment, right? Mm. So these are the things when I think about what cannabis has really been about for us and owning a dispensary has been about for us. It's been about ending the drug war. It's been about shining a light on, you know, having to check that felony box, right? You get out of jail, you got busted with less than an ounce of weed, and now you're forever checking a felony box. Really?
Yep.
Really? Really, really? So these are the things When I think about the cannabis business, and don't get me wrong, Simply Pure as a location and as a business is my happy spot. I love being in my dispensary. It's beautiful. It's fantastic.
It is.
People there are there, but that's not the owning the dispensary was not the goal.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Don't want to minimize at all pieces of your talk. And see, this is why you should just be recording by yourself, because I'm chopping it up. But don't want to minimize at all what you spoke about in that talk, Pot Power and Politics, about, you know, the current criminal legal system and how, you know, you have experienced it and others around you, especially when it comes to cannabis as a Black person, which is very different, as you just named, from experiencing cannabis as a white person or other person. And so it becomes doubly, triply more important that, you know, you are the person leading this charge, because you do not minimize ever the relation that or the impact cannabis has had on the Black community and the criminal legal system. So thank you for that. And I guess, you know, for the listeners who obviously weren't at the ULF retreat, sorry about that. I would love if you could just provide a bit more of, you know, how you clarity around how you came to give that talk, Pot, Power, Politics, the three P's, and like just a few bullets. I don't know, when we're speaking, do you still say the word bullets? About like the key points of that talk and what you always want the audience to take away when you give that talk.
So the idea of Pot, Power, and Politics tends to be the core of what I like to talk about, because I see how all of those tie themselves together. Politics has always been something that I've been involved in for probably the last 30 years. I believe in politics, and I believe in political power, and I believe in the political power of proximity, meaning that the closer that you get to the people who are making the rules and the laws in which you live by, and the better that you can insert yourself to be able to influence what those laws look like that you live by, the better lifestyle we will have. Case in point, 1960s, you know, Black people are coming up, we're fighting in the streets, we're trying to make things happen, we're trying to get better jobs, but we did not have as many people elected into Congress, or, you know, US senators or mayors or city council people. The drug laws or the drug war was the way in which the United States government controlled Black and brown people and communities. And I always want to go back to communities, because there's always some white guy in the audience who goes, oh, I got arrested in Chicago, you know, and I'm like, I'm sure you did. But the white community was not devastated. Those living in, you know, white kids smoking weed in Beverly Hills, you know, their families didn't lose their homes and their jobs, and they weren't locked up in prison. And we didn't effectively take generations of, and at the time, it was mostly young Black boys between the ages of 17 and 24 that the war on drugs made criminals and then made slaves. As we all know, we've seen the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment allows, ends slavery, but it allows for slavery if you happen to be incarcerated. The minute that slavery ended, we started to incarcerate 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old Black boys.
Yep.
American history at its finest. And that has not changed until, quite frankly, 13 years ago when we started to legalize cannabis. Yep. So why was cannabis the issue for mass incarceration? Because we know that Americans smoke weed. We know it. White Americans, Black Americans, Brown Americans, Chinese Americans, gay Americans, straight Americans, women Americans, men Americans, we all smoke weed, despite what the world will tell you. And I knew that because I grew up here in Colorado, and I have smoked weed with elected officials, doctors, lawyers, students, moms, dads. There is no group that I have not actually consumed cannabis with. Mm-hmm. So that being said, a cop can look at a car and see three white guys in it, know that there's weed in it, but know that their parents all have access to lawyers and everything else. It's not worth arresting those boys because they'll be out within 20 minutes and it's a waste of time. I can see a car of Latino or Black boys go by and I can pull over that car. I can have all four of those boys in orange jumpsuits working slave labor within the next 24 hours.
Yep.
And the reason why we can do it with cannabis and we want to do it with or why we have done it with cannabis is because we know that cannabis is not addictive. And we know that the minute that we put you in that orange jumpsuit, you can start working. We don't have to detox you. We don't have to send you to medical treatment. You're good to go, you know? Why do we choose boys between the ages of 17 and 24? Because that's an optimum work thing. You're the strongest that you're gonna get. You're the least likely to have friends that are attorneys or money for attorneys or families that have attorneys. You are a perfect slave. And that's what happened to my brother. You know, he was arrested at 17. He was in prison by the time he hit his 18th birthday. He spent the next 4 years in prison picking cotton for the cotton industry. Mm-hmm. A black boy in Texas picked cotton for the cotton industry in 1992, not 1892, 1992. My brother was a slave. California brags about it every year that they have slaves out, I'm sorry, they have inmates fighting the California wildfires in which they get paid $1 a day. Great, they're being taught a skill. They're helping out California. They're paying off their debt. They're doing all these wonderful things. When we pay them $1 a day, we're calling them slaves.
Yep.
So power politics, right? So the closer that we are able to be in this industry and to be versed enough and powerful enough to talk politics, to make sure that the people that we are electing to office are hearing our voices and we're saying no more power politics. And so to me, this is the end of slave labor. This is, and that's why it says when we got into this industry 13 years ago and why we have stopped speaking, have not stopped speaking about slave labor is because that's what this is about. Mass incarceration, slave labor, privatized prison systems. And then it gets even a bit more nefarious than that because now Americans can invest in prisons. So we can invest in the failure of our brethren. I mean, what kind of crap is that? I mean, I'm gonna invest in your failure. And if I'm an investor, just, I don't wanna get long-winded here, but if somebody invests in my restaurant and my investor comes in on a Saturday night and my restaurant is empty, my investor is gonna walk over to me and be like, Wanda, you need to get people in these seats. Yep. It's Saturday night. I want my investment protected and I want these seats filled.
Yep.
If I'm invested in a prison and I walk into the prison and all of the cages aren't filled,
yep,
I'm gonna go to the prison warden and be like, yo, I'm an investor. I want these cages filled, right? So how do we fill those cages? Cannabis. Cannabis, because we know everybody smokes it.
Yeah.
But we know the people who don't have lawyers. So the black and brown communities have been targeted for decades. And we can show that now through the Nixon administration, through the Reagan administration, we can show that they targeted our communities, which effectively took our dads, our brothers, our sons out of our communities, which left us broken families, generational trauma, lack of wealth. All of that can be tied to the drug war. So, hot power politics.
Yeah. It is that. And your delivery, thank you for doing what you just did in what, like a quarter of the time you had, or even less than that. Because all of those truths that you name are extremely important to realize how insidious these things are all tied together. Meanwhile, like, fun dispensaries exist all over the place that are not black owned or black supported.
In Colorado, out of, I believe it's 717 dispensaries, but somewhere in that ballpark, we have 4 black owned dispensaries. 4 out of 717.
Quick math, that's like 1%. That's like less than 5%.
Oh, I mean, across the country, we're less than 5%.
Yeah. And I think even connected to like what the drug war is, the drug narrative that especially black people are handed when it comes to cannabis use. And I personally have had to fight that own battle in my family personally, because it's not an evil drug. It is not something that turns our community into like bad people or addicts or like disempowered people. And I feel like that narrative is so harmful to spread. And it's something that is just deeply rooted in the community that we have right now.
It's the 100 years of really negative, effective marketing about this plant and about the people who use it that have been able to do this. It, you know, Louis Armstrong, I believe he was like the third person arrested in the United States for use of cannabis, right? And yeah, Louis Armstrong, there's a terrifying character in American history, right? I mean, you know, he might just play you a song, you know, yeah. Oh dear God. But we have been taught, and once again, and not by accident, because you're probably too young, but that whole DARE program, Dare to Say No to Drugs.
I remember DARE.
Nancy Reagan, just say no. You know who that was funded by? Tobacco and alcohol. And I'm confused that somehow or another tobacco and alcohol did such a great job of convincing white America that wine, beer, whiskey, and tobacco are not drugs. Hello. What are we addicted to in this country? Wine, beer, alcohol, and tobacco. So the fact that those were the sponsors of the DARE program lets you know exactly how this marketing went, right? So then, and it's even crazy because you can't watch a show about college from 1960 on and not see a bunch of white kids smoking weed, but yet somehow or another, you know, Ray Ray and his friends are the problem, right? You know, in our communities, you know, our mothers and, you know, saw our fathers arrested and, oh man, you know, weed got your dad arrested. No, weed laws got your dad arrested. The anti race or the racist drug war got your dad arrested or your brother thrown into jail or someone lost a career because these laws were racist, had zero to do with the plant, right? Yep. So yeah, all of that negative marketing needs to change. And it's because of young women like yourself. It's because of, you know, accomplished black folks that are saying, no, it's not the plant, it's the drug. Let me tell you one other quick story that I found really interesting. So years ago in our dispensary, there was a product called Toast mm-hmm. cigarettes. And they were cannabis joints, but they were rolled to look just like cigarettes. It had a filter on the top. It was very well done, a beautiful package, but it looked just like it was indistinguishable from a cigarette. When they first came in, the young women will tell me it's because I'm old. I was like, okay, well, this is kind of interesting, right? Because you could be smoking it and someone thinks you're smoking a cigarette and not a joint, you know? And, you know, a cop can't see you, you know, all the way across the park and come running over there because you got a cigarette in your hand, right? And so I showed this to the young woman who was working for me at the time, my marketing director, Kaylee Wilder, who was amazing. And her and her friend who used to work for Black Enterprise Magazine, they looked at me, their eyes got big, and they pulled back and they're like, why would we want someone to think we were smoking a cigarette instead of a joint? Like, who would smoke a cigarette? Oh God, you know? And so it was kind of interesting. And it was, the light came on, right? It was like, nobody wants to smoke a cigarette. Like, who would do that? You know, so it, marketing, it all changes, right? So now we are pro-cannabis. Yeah. Young women are pro-cannabis. Young men are pro-cannabis. Black people are pro-cannabis because it does good things for us. And we're changing that marketing narrative.
Yeah, and where you're doing it, I'm stepping into it. It feels scary, but one foot after the other, as you said, Wanda. And for me, even when I discovered cannabis for myself, you know, it's brought me, I'm a very anxious person. I'm high strung, I have so much energy. You know, that comes from generational trauma. My gut had issues. I mean, there's just like a series of things that we as a Black community deal with that we just don't talk about because everyone else is dealing with it. Like the high stress, the high anxiety, we feel that in our bodies. And I know cannabis for me has helped me release a lot of that. And it's helped me calm my monkey mind in so many ways. So more positive marketing, so pro-cannabis over here, and it is so possible to consume cannabis, smoke cannabis, and have a life. Like that has not been conceptualized widely enough, and so I just want to continue to help you do that.
So it's funny that you say that. I mean, I would say that even bigger than that, right? And I think that you can, because you're right, people's minds aren't calm, you know? And let me be the first one to tell you, every single one of my friends over the age of 35 cannot sleep. All of them. Not one of them, not some of them, not most of them. All of them cannot sleep. And it's because of the life that we have created and the stress level that we have created as Americans. There's even a badge of honor that goes along with not with overworking and not eating and not sleeping. Be like, oh girl, I ain't eating 2 days. And, you know, I got four programs going on. I got these, you know, six papers I got to write. And people wear that as a badge of honor. And I'm like, that's not a badge. That's failing miserably at your life.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, sit down, eat, you know, take a minute, breathe, go for a walk, go pet your dog, smoke a joint, God damn it. You know, I mean, relax for a minute, right? You know, so we need to change that narrative of, and I'm going to say Americans, because I think that we're probably the worst about it, but we need, you know, that perpetual busy cycle isn't, that's not a happy place.
Yeah.
And if cannabis can kind of help us step back for, you know, 30 minutes and quell your mind, quell your gut. And that's exactly what weed does, right? When you got that thing going on. And it's probably the, well, it's the plant in itself, but that whole being able just to, let me just think for a minute. Give me a second. And we need that.
Ah, slow down. Time.
Yeah. Go eat something. Because I got the munchies now and I'm hungry.
No, literally. And not even, like, yes, that. And, like, seriously, Wanda, when I tell you in school, I used to skip meals often because there's too much to do. And, like, to belabor that point, we are in such a hustle and grind energy as a as an American population.
Crazy.
Whew. Yes. So thank you so much for going down that path with me. But you are not a one-dimensional woman by far. You have passion and purpose. And I know in our first call before we even got on the show together, you know, you were telling me all about kind of like just personal power, keeping yourself motivated. And you said this very important quote to me that I have like repeated to other people and other people. I want you to know I got it from Wanda James. And it is that, you know, my life, your life, any of our lives is, they're not dress rehearsals. I've told that to my mom. It is not a dress rehearsal. Like, I'm in this body, in this life, you may reincarnate, whatever you believe, but right now this is not a dress rehearsal and you have one life to live. So what are you doing to live that life you want to live? Like, we're not playing around. It's not practice. Maybe it was practice when you were like 12, but now it's life. And so I just want to know, like, how did you, I mean, you've just done so many amazing things. How have you gotten to that place? What made you realize that? And what has kept you like super motivated and just, you know, saying F the dress rehearsal, this is my life.
You know, I think that we talked a little bit about this as well too. And I always want to be crystal clear when we do these interviews, right? You know, like I said, I didn't turn, you know, 18 and go, I'm gonna go to college, then I'm gonna join the military, then I'm gonna get this great job in corporate America, and then you know what? I'm gonna find the man that I love, we're gonna open a restaurant, and then when I'm about 40 years old, I'm gonna open up a dispensary. You know, I mean, that was not my life. I joined the military. I got to CU Boulder and I had no idea why I was there. I didn't understand the college experience. I didn't understand what I could be. I was the first, once again, first gen. I didn't know you could be a marketing director. I didn't know you could own a business. I didn't know any of this stuff. I'm a poor little black girl. I did not know. Came back second year and all my black friends were gone. They didn't come back. So we went from 2,000 black kids having this great time to, I don't know, 30 of us. And I was like, oh my God, what happened? Mm-hmm. I felt really alone at CU. 30,000 mm-hmm. students, I'm out there, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. White kids are running around in BMWs, I didn't know what a BMW was. You know, I mean, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I got scared. And when I got scared, I retreated to a place that made sense to me, which was the military. Mm-hmm. I grew up on a military base. My dad was military. I spoke the language. I saw the uniforms. I joined ROTC because I was scared. I was scared. I didn't know what to do, you know? So I went to a place that was comfortable for me. So in doing that, I became, we think, the first African-American woman commissioned through the Naval ROTC unit at CU. I didn't wake up one morning and go, I'm the first African-American woman that graduates from CU, that gets commissioned at CU. You know, it was a point of fear that took me there, right? That box checked a lot of things for me that I didn't understand at the time, but that when I got out of the military, I would be in demand to headhunters. I didn't know anything about a headhunter. I've never heard of a headhunter unless it was in a Tarzan movie. I mean, what the hell is it? Why don't I want to be headhunted? What's that about? You know? I had never heard of that until I got out of the military and a girlfriend of mine said, you know, there's a couple of headhunters that want to talk to you, you know? It got me a corporate job. I went into insurance. That was my first big corporate job at a huge insurance firm. Hated it. Insurance? Are you kidding me? Oh no, I don't want to do that.
Oh my God.
I was fortunate enough to get headhunted again into another corporate place. Discovered after 5 years in corporate, I didn't like corporate. It wasn't, yes, were I good at it? Could I show up every day and do a job? Yeah, but I was always trying to figure out how can I get out of this? How can I leave early today? Because I don't want to be here in this job. met my husband in a bar. We had a great time. He happened to be a chef. We used to go to this place, this Jamaican cafe. It was one of his Jamaican friends that owned it. Her and her husband ended up getting a divorce, and she goes, we're selling the business. And Scott looked at me and goes, you want to buy a restaurant? And I'm like, yeah, like, I guess. I don't know. Sure. Well, what does that mean? That we would own it? We run it? How does that work? You know? So things happen in your life because you show up. Mm-hmm. Be there. And that's the point I'm saying is, this is not a dress rehearsal, right? Mm-hmm. Be there, do your life, do this podcast. Where does this lead you? I don't know. You know, maybe somebody will see it, and before you know, you're doing the red table talk. You know, and got your, you know, you have the blue table talk, your teal table talk, which we're in today. Looks very nice, by the way. Really pretty colors on here. But you just don't know where it goes. But that's what comes from being present in your life, right? Even opening up that dispensary 13 years ago, that was terrifying. We thought we were going to go to jail. And people was like, what the hell are you doing? And politicians were telling me nobody would ever speak to me again because I've admitted to getting high. And all this stuff, right? But we did anyway, because that was what was our greatest movement at that time. And now when I look back on an entire lifetime of stuff, I kept showing up, kept putting that one foot in front of the other, kept being in the game, right? You know what I mean? Because not a dress rehearsal.
Yep.
You're in it.
Yeah.
You're in it. You're in it. You know, this is the Super Bowl. This is the Super Bowl. You know, you don't get do-overs. I know you do get do-overs, you do, but you don't get a do-over your entire life, but you get to fix things and change things. And even sometimes the things that don't work out the way that you thought they would, they take you to a place that you didn't know you were going to be, right?
Yeah.
You know, like I said, like the military, that was a point of fear for me. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a point of strength or of, you know, great resolve or a great plan. It was a point of fear. I was afraid.
Yep.
And I went to where I felt the most comfortable.
And what I'm hearing you say, Wanda, is that fear is something you alchemize, like maybe not even knowingly, but you turned the fear and you took it and you kept going anyway, knowing that you were scared, knowing that there was something in you still unsettled, and still push forward. And I think that is so important to broadcast and pause on a little bit, because it is not, people are not out here 100% fearless. Like, we can say like, oh, ditch the fear, or like, oh, be bold. there is still so much. There's trembling, there's your guts freaking out on you. Like, it's when you're on a roller coaster, like your gut, you're going up the hill, and your gut is like, this is bad, this is going to be bad. And in fact, you know it's going to be bad, because when you get over that hill, oh, everything is happening in your stomach, right? It is so important to just know that you can be scared and do things anyway. Like, you can not know and do something anyway. And it often, when I find myself talking to like peers and friends, like, okay, maybe you don't know exactly what, you don't have a 5-year plan. I don't, you know, I think I have one. It's probably wrong, right? Because the way my life has gone. So if you just put one step, like you're saying, you know, it dissipates, or you learn, or you figure it out, and something comes to you. Being present allows something to come to you to steer you in the direction that maybe is more certain. So,
and your plan is not wrong. It may not be the plan that you continue on, but, you know, once again, your plan is going to take you to another place.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My husband and I are laughing because I'm running for political office, which is crazy.
Exciting.
It's exciting. It's very exciting. And I'm loving every minute of it. I have no control over what the voters are going to do. Zero. Zip, 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 zero. I might win this election. I might not. But what I do know is at the end of this election, the day after Election Day, I'm going to be at a different place.
Yeah.
Somewhere, right? And I don't know where this is going to take me. You know, maybe Richard Branson's going to hear me talk and, you know, put me on a spaceship. And
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm going to Mars next year because I'm going to meet Richard Branson through this campaign. Yeah, I don't know.
Seriously. That is how this goes, though. It's crazy. Yeah.
That's exactly how, you know, life works. The only thing that I can tell you that I think when I think of failure is when you stop doing something, when fear prevents you from moving forward, right?
Yep.
I'm not gonna open up another restaurant because the last one didn't work.
Yep.
Girl, the time you should open up another restaurant is because the last one didn't work. Now you know what not to do.
Literally.
Now you know what not to do. You know, all of our restaurants weren't perfect. That first, the Jamaican Cafe, I mean, it's Scott and I, it's like our warm spot, we love it. But man, we laugh at the mistakes we made. After the fifth restaurant, we were like, what the hell were we thinking about? And how do we even get past opening night, you know, for all the mistakes that we made, right?
Yeah.
But you know, we were young and we were in it and we charged forward, you know? And now it's the place that makes us laugh the most because I'm like, we had no clue what we were doing. Zero clue. Beyond zero clue, you know? But that one restaurant got us all the way over here to a dispensary.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, fear is a, don't live in fear, but know that fear is a, it's a good motivator.
It is.
And it's a emotion that we're supposed to have, all of our emotions that we're supposed to have, but we're supposed to work through them and have them work with us and not against us.
Yeah, you're right. And to not minimize how fear can be translated to you too. People can give you their fear and we say, no, thank you for that.
parents are famous for that, giving you their fear out of, and it's out of love. You know, they don't want to see you get hurt. We don't want to see you do anything that's going to, you know, damage you or whatever else. And so, and then they project a lot of their fear and the things that held them back, right? You know what I mean? And my dad has done that, you know, when I was in corporate America and I quit a 6-figure job with an executive level with a car. And my father didn't have, I mean, I don't know my dad ever made more than $40,000 in his life. So to hear his daughter talking about she's quitting a 6-figure job that gave her a car and medical benefits and an expense account, my dad is like, what are you doing? You know? And I was like, Dad, it'll be fine. You know, it's just not what I want to do. And, you know, and I'm sure he did not understand that and made zero sense to him.
Yeah. And yes, parents are famous for that. I love my parents so much. And being away from them has taught me so much about kind of that dynamic you're mentioning. Even when, sidebar, you know, I studied finance and I am grateful my dad pushed me to do that because it taught me a lot about how this world works, a lot. And I'm continuing to learn how this world works and is centered around money. But outside of that, you know, my father, you know, there are so many things that in his world, you know, didn't exist that I'm now super into. And to even connect our conversation to earlier, you know, it's always tone it down, tone it down, piercings and everything, like you're seeing on me, and pronouns I choose to use, like tone it down. I love my parents, and I say no thank you to the fear. So, and then that is how this podcast episode is even existing as well, because I'm saying no thank you to the fear. This is who I am and what I want to support. So.
And then in their day as well too, your parents are probably my age, but I mean, the ideas of, you know, having a tattoo, you know, or multiple tattoos or being pierced, or choosing different pronouns that our parents definitely, you know, don't understand and want to get, is now a very much normal way of the world, you know what I mean? And I explain it to my mom, and you know, and she says whatever when she says different things. I'm like, Mom, just like the Beatles were radical in your day because they had long hair, you know, but they moved a generation forward. Know that every generation is going to do what it's going to do to put their mark on what their generation means. And, you know, do once again, it's your life through your tattoos, through your piercings, through your pronouns.
My cannabis, like all of it.
It's your life. It's in a very different place than what our parents are. But know that parents have got nothing but love. You know what I mean? And their fear is based in, you know, what they think is going to hold you back, but in reality, which might be the very thing that propels you forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Wanda. Okay.
And one day gets done with your parents as well, too. That's always an experience.
Wanda, you have no idea how badly I want that to happen. They will never do it. They will never do it. They could both use it.
They will, but you know what? You got to go to them in like a different format. You got to show up with like some Coda chocolates or some truffles that have like the little sprinkles on them that look like Godiva. I mean, don't dose them without them knowing it, but let them know, see how beautiful it is. Be like, look at this beautiful piece of chocolate. You know what I mean? And try, Mom, try a little piece of chocolate with
just a little bit.
We're going to sit here this afternoon and we're going to have one piece of chocolate together. That's what we're going to do.
And then we can paint. We can paint. We can go on a walk. Like,
I bet you can get Mom to do a gummy or a chocolate with you. I bet you can.
After she hears
you. Show up with a dab rig and a nail or a torch. That ain't gonna happen. So don't do that. But you know, don't do that. Do not do that. But you know what? Show up with a beautiful piece of chocolate.
Oh my God. No, you're right. You're right. After she hears this, maybe she'll reconsider. Or maybe they'll both reconsider. Oh my gosh. Thank you for laughing with me, by the way. I love when guests can come on the show and laugh because that's so important. Okay, Wanda. We're wrapping up our time here, but I want to just ask for your reflections. We are in a super pivotal moment in history for Black women. Okay, let's set the stage. As you mentioned, when you came to speak to our ULF class, 95% of our class is Black women. And not just Black women, like, even though Black women are awesome regardless, but empowered Black women who are pouring and investing into their progression and leadership and power. Okay, that's our class. We also have new Supreme Court Justice-elect, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who has just been appointed to the highest court in the land, Black woman, right? And then I happen to have the honor of having Wanda James on my podcast right now, who is the first Black woman dispensary owner in America, right? So, and first of many things, as you mentioned. So what are your, first of all, Black women are taking over, that's the first thing. But what are your, like, how have you managed, because I know this is a weight, I was the first Black consultant at my firm. How do you manage the weight of being first Black woman yourself, not dress rehearsal? How have you managed that weight, and how do you continue to manage it, stepping in and even running for the CU Boulder Board of Regents as well?
I said this in the class. We read and more weed. Thank God for weed. Oh, Lord. No. serious answer to all of that. You know, and it was amazing watching Justice Jackson answer questions like, define woman. She's like, I'm a judge, not a biologist. You know, is this baby racist? I don't know. I haven't met that baby on the cartoon book yet. I mean, the questions were were insulting. And I think every Black woman in America, you know, we all saw the memes, the facial expressions, because we know what she wanted to say, right? How do you manage all of that? You manage all of that because you know who you are and what you are and the shoulders that you stand on. And you know that the person standing in front of you ain't got on you. Ain't got the level of intelligence, the level of know-how, the ability to move mountains, the intellect, you know. And it's not an arrogance. And that's people who just heard me say that. I was like, so arrogant. It's not an arrogance by any stretch. It goes back to what we talked about the very first thing when Nelson Mandela talked about. It's not our fear. It's our greatest fear is our own light shining, right? So, no. And you know this. You and I have had these conversations, and it really warms my soul when I see you connect to the words that I'm saying. And it's not that I'm telling you anything that you don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm affirming what you know.
And I'm grateful.
And we've had this conversation. And when you spoke about, you know, I'm a serial entrepreneur and I'm all over the place. I got this, I got that, I got this energy going on and everything else. Before you and I ever talked, you knew what that was, right? All I did was shine a light and says, and that's perfectly normal and perfectly fantastic and really, truly awesome for where you are in your life. But you knew that already, did you not? Did you know that? Yeah. Stop laughing. Mm-hmm. But seriously, look at me. I mean, did you know that about you?
Yes.
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 Yeah. Mm-hmm. Say it with a period.
Yes.
Yeah. You knew that. All I did was affirm that for you because you knew it. So when you talk about how did Justice Jackson sit there and take all that, because she knew that she was the baddest woman in that seat. No, baddest person in that seat. She knew it already, right? Just like you did. Now, we just need to make sure that we're able to affirm that in everybody else that's coming up with us to be able to give permission to say yes, period. Not yes with a smile, like, yeah, you know, I kind of got, I don't know, I can get. No, it's, yeah, I can do all of this behind me. When I got each of these degrees and things and commissions, when they handed those to me, I didn't feel worthy of those. I didn't. I was like, oh my God, I got a commission. Dear God. You know, now when I look back on it, you know why I got that commission? Because I earned it.
Exactly.
Because I earned it. So, yeah. And I'm expecting you to affirm that for all the other Black women in your circle. You know, when they come to you and, oh man, I can't believe, you know, and I'm really, no. That's how we do it. You know, may you have the confidence of a mediocre white man. you know, seriously, you know, white men come into this world and they think that they are earned, or they think they are deserving of those degrees, of those jobs, of those positions, of the money, of the status, of the titles. And the world confirms that for them at a very young age.
Yep. Very young.
I kind of want to say something, and I've got to be very cryptic about it because I don't want the person that it happened to feel weird. But I was at a event lately, a big Democratic event. And there was a woman sitting next to me who has a very young son. He's probably 2 years old. Cute little guy. Little white. As we were seated at the very front table, she was at the front table with us. As the speakers were coming on, the little boy walked up on the stage and he got up there and was real cute and everybody clapped and, you know, everything else. And she came and got him. And through every speaker then for the next hour and a half, this little boy was up on stage doing things. Mm-hmm. The person that I was with leaned over to me and said, "It is amazing that white men at that age are already being confirmed that they can be up on the stage taking power and time and energy away from the speaker." If that was me, my parents would have snatched my that stage and made me sit down.
Literally. Yep.
But a little young white boy for an hour and a half got to play on that stage and stand up on that stage and run over to the speaker and run back from the speaker, which had to be horribly disruptive to the speaker. Finally, in the audience, it was a very powerful, very well-known black woman in Colorado that went up because the little boy took him out of the event. But it was interesting to me when I saw that happen, and I'm like, wow, 3 years old, he thinks he belongs on that stage. And nobody took him off that stage. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, but there's, yeah. Like, yeah.
From day one, they are taught that they belong there.
Yeah.
My goal is from day one to make sure you know you belong there. If you're in the room, you belong in the room. If you're on the stage, you earn the right to be on that stage. You get one of these shiny pieces of paper, you earned it. If your podcast goes viral, it's because of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Wanda.
From now on, when someone says, do you know how bad you are, you're going to say yes.
Yes. Yes, period.
No, yeah, I am. It was because I had blah, 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 blah. No, yes, period.
Yes. I earned it.
You earned it.
Thank you. Yeah, because I've been working my butt off.
Hello.
Oh, man. No, but not to minimize everything you just said. Yes, like exactly. And it's so easy. Things get so easily taken away from black communities. So thank you.
And then they give you excuses. Well, you're only here because you're the affirmative action hire. You're only here because, we didn't hire the other three black guys because we had to put a black woman in that space. And you can be like, Judge Jackson, I've got more judicial experience, a better resume, a higher from the best college on the law thing. I mean, when we rattle off her degrees and her know-how as a judge, she was the most qualified judge on the bench. Yet all of those Republicans made it sound like somehow or another Amy Coney Barrett, who has never tried a case, is a better attorney. And we all know that that's not true.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to leave you with as well, too, the poem that I love the most was Amanda Gorman, and I just love her stuff, and I'm loving reading her things. But the poem that she did at the inauguration when she says, America is not yet written.
Mm-hmm.
We're 400 years into this experiment, right? 1964 was when Black Americans got the right to vote. I was 1 year old in 1964. When I was born, Black people couldn't vote. In less than 60 years, which, don't get me wrong, is a long time for me to be on this planet. I'm actually getting close to that number. But in less than 60 years, we've elected a Black president, a Black vice president, put a Black woman on the Supreme Court. Well, we put a number of Black people on the Supreme Court, but now we finally have a Black woman on the Supreme Court. We've had a Black man on the Supreme Court, not Clarence Thomas, Thurgood Marshall, before Clarence Thomas. We'll even include Clarence Thomas with his, you Black, but anyway. So we've done this. We have done more than any demographic in this country in less than 60 years after getting a vote. Black women are the most educated demographic in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even 400 years into this country yet.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, America's not yet written yet.
Mm-hmm.
And your generation is going to be spectacular.
Thank you. Thank you. We're trying.
No, you're going to be spectacular, no doubt.
Thank you.
I'm going to be having you on my podcast when I'm 85 years old. I'm going to have like the old broad podcast. Actually, it'll be the old broad hologram because podcasts will be so like,
they'll
2022.
Old.
It'll be a hologram. So you're going to be my guest on the hologram.
Wanda, first of all, don't date yourself. You're not old. It comes with all this other stuff attached to it. You are Wanda.
I know, and I feel that. It's crazy to me as well, too. I'm like, oh, Lord, I want another plan. And, you know, and that's the other thing, too, that, you know, in changing, you know, where we are as women, my mother will never tell you her age. As a matter of fact, my mother now claims she's younger than I am. And I'm like, Mom, you got to stop that because that's not going to work any longer. But anyway, I look at it the other way, right? I'm proud as punch that I'm 58 years old. And to me, that is... I think it's a phenomenal place to be. I have loved every decade of my life. I don't want to be, you know, 22. I don't want to be 35. Yeah. I want to be fantastic at 58, which is why I said at 85 years old, I'm going to have a hologram show and you're going to be on it. So we're going to be doing this.
Well, we are. I'm holding you to that, first off. No, I'm serious. I'm holding you to that.
Yeah, see, that's what we're going to be doing.
And... you're right, because guess what? You've been living your life. And so
living your life. Live it all. You know what I mean? If you've had an inkling to do it, do it. Do it.
Okay. Well, listeners, audience members and viewers, because we're in season 3 and we're on video, I guess you just gotta live your life now. No. but wow. I'm sure all of you are, yeah, processing, listening, grateful. I'm feeling very grateful I've had Wanda on the show. It is so, you just have a great talent because you are unapologetically yourself. And I think that is not normal. Like, that is not a normal thing taught, especially with the identities you hold. And I think because it is not normal, because it is something that I had for once not seen in such an elegant way done. I really appreciate that. So thank you for like sharing your energy and what you mentioned, like, you know, you're here to affirm Black women, other people to kind of just live their lives, be unapologetic, and also realize like what power and proximity can do to support our greater good and our society. I think that is so powerful. So thank you for spreading your message today. And listeners, I know you're grateful, so I'm speaking for you. They say thank you for spreading your message today, Wanda. I know you are running right now for the CU Board of Regents, and listeners will probably hear this in sometime in May, but how can listeners like see what you're up to, follow you? Where are you present in the online sphere?
I got my own hologram. Nothing. No. I'm online. Wanda L. James on Twitter, IG, Facebook. The campaign is Wanda, the number 4 CU, on all of those things as well too. And Wanda4CU.com is the website. The election for me will be the big election. Will be the primary election on June 28th. Since it's a CD congressional district race, it's considered a statewide seat because we take care of all 4 campuses, which is Anschutz Medical Center, Children's Hospital, and then CU Boulder, CU Denver, and UCCS in Colorado Springs. The Board of Regents operates a $5.2 billion budget, oversees a $5.2 billion budget, the 3rd largest employer in the state of Colorado. Mm. We have not had a Black woman on the board since 1984. It's been 38 years since we've had a Black woman on the board. Sadly, Black enrollment has not increased in the CU system since I matriculated 40 years ago. Mm. So those are the reasons why I'm running, because we need a Black woman's voice at the table, period. Somebody will always pull my race into it. And I'm like, because race matters. And, you know, and I'm tired of people saying that. Why do you gotta be about race? Because it is about race. Yeah. So anyway, June 28th is the election. I would ask everybody to vote. It's the one thing that breaks my heart when I see young Black people that tell me it's not important that they vote.
Yeah.
And races now, every political race is won by less than 3%. Mm-hmm. And less than 3% could be 3 votes, could be 2 votes, could be 1,000 votes. But every vote counts. So young people, please vote. And on that too, on my political soapbox, mm-hmm. I already have a college education. Mm-hmm. I already married the person that I love. We already own a house. Mm-hmm. If y'all think that you're going to be able to afford college, have children when you want to or when you don't want to, marry whom you love, of whatever gender that may be, or buy a home, y'all better vote and act like it matters to you, because all the laws that are being created right now affect you a lot more than they affect me. Mm-hmm. So please, young people, pay attention, get out there. And it's the smallest voting block, which is why we end up with 90-year-old people running the country, right? It's because your voices are not heard. So yeah, And don't let anybody tell you that voting doesn't matter. That's just the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. It's the most simple thing that you can do. It's the basis of your citizenship. And if it didn't matter, why would white folks be spending so much money and time to prevent you from voting?
So much. Years of money and time and political will, yeah.
Vote. Vote like your life depends on it, because it does. I would have never dreamed that 10 years ago that young women would have lost the opportunity to control their bodies. Mm. I would have never have dreamed that.
Yep.
And here we are.
Yep.
I don't want to be talking to you on our hologram and find out that black people lost the right to vote somewhere over that the next 40 years, right? Yeah. But understand, if we don't keep our eye on it and if we don't keep focused on it, that will happen.
Yeah.
I mean, just FYI, the Voting Rights Act has to be voted on every 5 years. Mm. To this very day, they decide whether black people can continue to vote or not. Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
That's a thing. So anyway, that's my soapbox. That's my political talk. Vote, 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 vote.
Not a soapbox. Yeah, thank you. And we'll make sure, listeners, that all that information is in the episode description. Make sure you read that. Follow Wanda on the socials. You see clearly she is talking about a lot of really important current events and also just sharing her story more widely. Because why do we still have people in prison? But anyway, all right. So thank you, listeners, again so much for tuning in. And always follow Working Within for more.